In reviewing the drugs that have actions on the central nervous system, we consider that in most step one examinations, about every sixth or seventh question in pharmacology would probably be something to do with CNS drugs. Not all of the areas of central nervous system pharmacology have equal importance for us, and I'll do my best to point out to you during our review of which areas I think are of the greatest yield in terms of your preparing for the exam and which perhaps are much less important. We're going to start by considering aspects of neuronal excitation. This is sort of a bit physiological, but I think it will be helpful for us. If you're imagining how we change neuronal activity, I'm sure we all have to say, well, it's because we change ion flux. And ion channels obviously are very important in terms of neuronal activity, and many of such ion channels actually can be regulated by neurotransmitters. For example, if you imagined how you would bring about a membrane depolarization, which is going to be an excitatory event as far as a neuron is concerned, one of the ways you could do that would be to open ion channels to sodium, so that sodium runs down its concentration gradient, taking a positive charge with it, and that opening of the sodium ion channel allowing such influx is quite excitatory. On the other hand, you could also imagine that since potassium is flowing out of cells all the time, if you prevented the efflux of potassium, then a positive charge would also appear on the inside of the membrane, and that again is tantamount to a membrane depolarization. What about inhibition of neurons? Certainly opening a chloride ion channel, allowing chloride to run down its concentration gradient into the cell, carrying a negative charge, would be inhibitory, and that would lead to membrane hyperpolarization. Likewise, enhancing the efflux of potassium, it's always going out, remember, but if you made it go out faster, then that would also be an inhibitory action through membrane hyperpolarization. Now, if we then turn around and say that such ion channels can either be regulated by voltages, and certainly we've described before some of the voltage-regulated sodium channels that occur in excitable tissues such as the heart, or it could be regulated by neurotransmitters. And in thinking about transmitter compounds, we would say that in some cases, transmitters, when they interact with their receptors, have a direct coupling to an ion channel. And in other cases, when receptors are activated by a transmitter, they actually go through mechanisms that involve second messengers, which in turn then, via phosphorylation events, will change ion flux. The figure that you see has two of the examples of ion channels that can be molecular targets for central nervous system drugs. The top part of the figure represents an ion channel that is perhaps controlled simply by changes in voltage on the membrane. A good example would be the sodium ion channel responsible for axonal conduction. When we conduct a nerve impulse along an axon, you may recall that changes in membrane potential sequentially allow for the opening of sodium ion channels, and sodium can run down its concentration gradient, taking a positive charge into the cell, and that is a depolarizing event. Likewise, we can imagine such situations where calcium ions can also go through voltage-dependent ion channels, and this would be very true of many presynaptic membranes, where the voltage change at a presynaptic membrane, permitting calcium to run down its gradient from the outside of the cell to the inside, would actually bring about a fusion of vesicles with presynaptic membrane, allowing for the release of neurotransmitter. Now, among the drugs that we think of most importantly in the area of agents that will work on this type of target would be a number of the anesthetic molecules and certainly some of the anticonvulsant drugs. So, in thinking about voltage-regulated ion channels, as far as neuropharmacology is concerned, we generally think about anesthetics and anticonvulsants. Now, we also said that we can open ion channels by neurotransmitters that are directly coupled to the ion channel via their receptors. And so we have a little diagram here showing a neurotransmitter interacting with a macromolecule in the membrane, which is coupled directly to an ion channel, allowing for movement of ions across this type of system. Now, among the different neurotransmitters that are directly coupled, we have to consider gamma-aminobutyric acid. We have to consider the excitatory transmitter glutamic acid, the inhibitory transmitter glycine, and certainly many targets for acetylcholine, of which nicotinic receptors would be a very good example. So when you then turn around and say, well, what drugs seem to work on these systems? Once again, anesthetic molecules would be a possibility, as would certain of the anticonvulsant drugs. Thinking of nicotine and other cholinergic drugs, which are presumably working through this type of receptor. And certain of the sedative hypnotics and anticonvulsants will also work on such systems, most notably those coupled to gamma-aminobutyric acid. Now, ion channels and receptors can also involve G proteins and second messengers. And so this next slide demonstrates a model for this, where we have a receptor to a neurotransmitter that is coupled through a G protein, which can change second messengers. Now, our most well-known second messengers from autonomic pharmacology are well represented here again, cyclic AMP and inositol triphosphate and diacylglycerol, and also calcium can be thought of as a second messenger as well. And these types of second messengers are responsible for protein phosphorylation, and it's the protein phosphorylation, presumably of proteins intimately connected with the ion channel, either activate or inhibit the ion channel function. And these actions then are brought about through biochemical second mechanisms. And there is even some evidence of long-term effects as well as the more rapid onset effects. What transmitters seem to go through this type of system in the central nervous system? Well, many of them. Certainly acetylcholine, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, the opioid peptides and possibly other peptides, these are all going through receptors that are coupled to second messengers. And as such, then, these systems, these neurotransmitter systems, become targets for many different drugs. I'm thinking here of the analgesic drugs, like the opioid analgesics, morphine, meperidine, codeine, etc. I'm thinking about drugs useful in the treatment of major depressive disorder, drugs useful in the treatment of psychoses, such as schizophrenia, and drugs that are useful for the alleviation of anxiety states. So these three sorts of system are the systems that we're going to be talking about when it comes to individual drug actions on the central nervous system. Now, before we can talk about the individual drugs, though, I think it might be worthwhile to remind you about the different types of neurotransmitter present in the central nervous system and what their functions might be. I start with amino acids in large part because these are actually, in terms of quantity, in the sense of, you know, regions of the brain, quantitatively, the most neurons in the brain seem to have receptors for glutamic acid. Well over half of our neurons can be responsive to glutamate. Now, glutamate, in the biochemical terms, of course, is an amino acid that can be used for protein synthesis and can be oxidizable for energy, etc. That's probably true in the brain as well. But in the brain, glutamate has a very special role. It is a very commonly used excitatory neurotransmitter, and in actual fact can increase the influx of cations, like sodium, for example, by a direct coupling mechanism. There are a number of different receptor subtypes for glutamic acid. The one that I usually advise people to have heard of is a receptor subtype called the NMDA receptor. That stands for N-methyl-D-aspartic acid. Now, we don't have any D-amino acids in our bodies, so you can immediately then say, ah, this must be a tool that neuroscientists use to characterize receptors. And you'd be quite right. That's, in fact, the case. But the NMDA receptor seems to be rather important for us in pharmacology. It probably is also important in neuroscience, because a lot of people believe that's related to consolidation of long-term memory, for example. A lot of people believe that the glutamate NMDA receptor is responsible for damage to neurons when you have a stroke or ischemic damage in the brain. But in pharmacology, not that we have very many drugs, but we have two rather interesting drugs that appear to be blockers of the NMDA receptor. One of them is an anesthetic called ketamine, a very unusual anesthetic drug, and we'll deal with that a little later. The other is the psychotomimetic drug, fencyclidine, or PCP. Both of these drugs happen to be capable of blocking NMDA receptors, and at least a part of their neuropharmacology seems to be expressed in that way. Now, like glutamate is an excitatory transmitter, gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. And it can inhibit neurons by one of two ionic mechanisms. It happens to have more than a single receptor subtype. The subtype GABA-A receptor is coupled to a chloride ion channel, and activation leads to chloride running into the cell, which leads to hyperpolarization. And the GABA-B receptor is coupled to a potassium ion channel, whereby activation leads to an increased efflux of potassium, which again would be tantamount to hyperpolarization. Now, in the context of GABA-A receptors particularly, we know that many anticonvulsants can work to facilitate the actions of GABA. Certainly sedative drugs can do that. Many sleeping pills or hypnotic drugs can do that, and so can muscle relaxants. So we have an awful lot of drugs here that seem to help out GABA, facilitate the inhibitory actions of GABA in the brain. Acetylcholine is, of course, not an amino acid, but an amine, a quaternary amine, and we've described acetylcholine certainly at some length in terms of autonomic pharmacology. In the brain, the dominant type of receptor for acetylcholine is an M1 receptor. You may recall that M1s are not very common in the periphery. They are in the GI tract, but usually we think of M2 receptors in the heart and M3 receptors in most peripheral tissues. But here, we've got M1 receptors as the most dominant type of receptor. This is a receptor which, upon activation, excites neurons. And it can do so by decreasing the efflux of potassium, allowing potassium to accumulate on the inside of the cell. And this is a coupled system because it involves changes in phospholipase C activity, leading to an increase in diacylglycerol. M2 receptors, see, they're not only in the heart, M2 receptors in the brain are inhibitory. And these inhibitory actions are brought about by increasing potassium efflux. But it's a different second messenger. This second messenger is a second messenger coupled negatively to cyclic AMP, and this then is a mechanism that is quite distinctive from the mechanism involving phospholipase C. So we have muscarinic receptors that are coupled through G proteins of opposite sorts, and we have nicotinic receptors that are not coupled because they're directly linked to cation channels, most notably sodium channels, and therefore sodium influx occurs, which is going to be excitatory. Now, in thinking about drugs that can affect these channels, well, by definition, nicotine must be affecting nicotinic receptors in the central nervous system. But our acetylcholinesterase inhibitors are also going to influence cholinergic function in the brain, and certainly that would be one of the reasons why we use acetylcholinesterase inhibitors in Alzheimer's dementia, Alzheimer's disease, because it appears to increase acetylcholine, and that is a deficiency, particularly in Meynert's nucleus. As far as the usefulness in Parkinson's disease is concerned, muscarinic blockers are used there, drugs like benztropine, because you want to offset the imbalance that's brought about in Parkinson's disease by a loss of dopamine leading to an excessive amount of acetylcholine. And if you can decrease the actions of acetylcholine at muscarinic receptors, you have a potential therapeutic strategy. Dopamine and norepinephrine are catecholamines. We've mentioned both of these compounds under autonomic pharmacology. In the brain, dopamine is inhibitory. There are multiple subtypes. The subtypes are generally considered to be G protein linked to cyclic AMP. Only one of them, by the way, is an excitatory, I'll put it this way, only one of them involves an increase in cyclic AMP. Most of them seem to involve decreases in cyclic AMP. And these are targets, the systems that involve dopamine, for a variety of drugs that are CNS stimulants. Amphetamine, for example, can act to cause release of dopamine, and as you would predict then, some of the actions of amphetamine, as well as concerning norepinephrine, actually do concern dopaminergic function. The use of levodopa in Parkinson's disease is an obvious clinical application of knowing about dopamine in the brain. And you should also know that there are many effects of antipsychotic drugs that seem to be expressions of their ability to block dopamine receptors. So you are decreasing dopaminergic transmission when you think about drugs like haloperidol or chlorpromazine in terms of their use as antipsychotic agents. Norepinephrine is distinctive in the sense of the central nervous system. The tracks for norepinephrine are quite different from the tracks for dopamine. Even though dopamine is a precursor of norepinephrine, they have very different neuronal pathways in the brain. Most of the cell bodies for norepinephrine neurons are present in the locus coeruleus or the lateral tegmentum. And again, there are differences in terms of the role of norepinephrine in the brain. Norepinephrine can be either excitatory or inhibitory. Alpha 1 and beta 1 receptors in the brain lead to excitation, and alpha 2 and beta 2 receptors in the brain lead to inhibition. And most of these actions are coupled to second messengers. Why are we interested in norepinephrine in the brain? Once again, because of the actions of central nervous system stimulants. So if we're thinking about drugs for attention deficit disorder, for example, like methylphenidate, or you're thinking about amphetamine, you're thinking about cocaine on occasion, then you would say, ah, yes, this is a group of drugs that might influence norepinephrine function, largely by increasing the activity of norepinephrine in the brain. Likewise, the use of antidepressant drugs, like tricyclic antidepressants, such as amitriptyline, is thought to at least in part involve an increased functional activity of norepinephrine in the central nervous system. A number of anxiolytic agents also fit into this category. Serotonin is not a catecholamine. Serotonin is an indole alkylamine, 5-hydroxytryptamine, 5-HT. This too can be excitatory or inhibitory. It reminds you a little bit of norepinephrine. And also, by the way, it's got very discrete pathways in the central nervous system in terms of where the cell bodies are. Most of the cell bodies for serotonin are in the Raf nuclei. But interestingly, one neuronal cell body can make as many as a million connections with other neurons. So if a neuron gets excited at all, then a lot of other neurons hear about it. There are at least 15 different subtypes of receptor for serotonin. I'm going to describe some of these for you a little later outside of the realm of CNS pharmacology because this is an important drug group of drugs that work on serotonin. This is sort of high yield. But as far as the central nervous system is concerned, most of the types of receptor for serotonin are coupled to second messengers other than one. And you might as well distinguish that now. It's called the 5-HT3 receptor subtypes. What drugs work here? CNS stimulants, antidepressants, anxiolytics, etc. So clearly we need to know a little bit about serotonin in the brain to really try to understand some of our CNS drugs that are very important. Opioid peptides. Well, there are a lot of different peptides in the brain that appear to play either transmitter or neuroregulatory roles, but for pharmacology, our most interesting ones are the ones that appeared to be classified as opioid peptides. I'm thinking here of MET and Luenkephalin, dynorphine, and of course beta endorphin. The peptides of this class tend to be inhibitory to neurons. Once again, there are several receptor subtypes. We'll need to describe those for you, because different opioid analgesics have different actions on these subtypes, and they're coupled to second messengers. And our most important drug group in this arena, of course, are the drugs that we would call, by definition, opioid analgesics. And this is the morphine family.